1790-something, Jonathan Edwards preached one of the most famous sermons ever known, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God had 67 points, right? Like points that he made in the course of it. Fast forward to Dwight Moody, right? And Spurgeon and these great revivalist preachers of the second half of the 1800s. These guys varied between 15 and 20 points per sermon. Fast forward to Billy Graham, 4 points per sermon. Fast forward to Haddon Robinson and today's seminary instruction. You know what we're supposed to give you as preachers? One. They tell us to say one thing over and over in different ways for a half hour, and that hopefully is what you can walk away with. It's called the big idea sermon. It's called the big point sermon. And what you do is you look for a principle in a text. So if I was here in 2 Samuel 2 and 3, and if I was teaching you, my goal would be to find a key principle in here that I feel like you folks should leave with, and then apply it to your life at the end. Is everybody looking at me? You folks are much smarter than that. You are much smarter than that. The greatest struggle in the church today is the lack of general Bible knowledge on the part of adults in the church. You hear what I said? The greatest struggle in the church today, particularly as a leader, is the lack of general Bible knowledge on the part of adults in the church. And this has come as a result of a lot of the dumbing down of teaching. I am not going to dumb down this text for you. This is a very difficult text that we're going into. Intricate narratives are the most difficult texts to deal with. Right? In a lot of sermon series that you hear on 2 Samuel, you just skip chapters 2 and 3 because A, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and B, you can't find a key principle in it. Right? There is no key overriding principle in this. There's not meant to be. This is a story. Now, I'm going to, at the end, bring it back around to each of us and bring it back around to this introduction that I just gave you. But I want you to understand like where I'm coming from today as your teacher so that you can understand the posture that you need to take as students and so that together we can interact with the text in the way that it's meant to be interacted with so that the richness of the story is what can come through as opposed to just some spoon-fed principle that we all hope that we can walk away with. Because I think that you guys are up to a lot more than just one point. I think that you have the ability to engage story. I think that God made you with minds and hearts to be able to really be transformed by the Word of God in deeper ways. And so as we work through our text today, this is going to be me telling you a story from the text of Scripture with some possible thoughts thrown in around it. And then a conclusion that hopefully will bring it back around to what I'm saying now. So remember what I'm saying now. I'm going to stop saying it. And we can put it on the shelf over here, and we'll head into the text. But when we come back to it, remember that we said all this. 2 Samuel chapter 2. In 2 Samuel 2, the story begins to open up for us of basically David's second half. Right? David up to this point has defeated Goliath, and then Saul decided that he hated him after he decided that he loved him. And David's been on the run ever since. But then Saul and Jonathan died. And 2 Samuel 1 was David processing Saul and Jonathan's death. And then we get to chapter 2, verse 1. After this, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." David said to him, "To which shall I go?" And he said to him, "To Hebron." All right, so here we go. When we think about the text today, we got to bring ourselves into the story. This is about a people, about humans set in real time with real emotions on a real plot of ground that was called their nation, and they had enemies, and they're struggling with their national identity and what it means for them to be the people of God. At this time, what we have is the kingdom of Israel is in blue. Is this blue? That's blue. I'm colorblind. So in blue. This is pretty much the boundaries of the kingdom of Israel. What you have down here along the coast is Philistia, right? The land of the Philippines. Down here is the Amalekites. What did I just say? All right. The land of the Philippines, yes. The land of Pacific Islander people who are great at languages. All right. Here we have the Philistines, who are mean and dumb and aren't good at languages. Here we have the Amalekites, who are treacherous. And here we have the Edomites, the sons of Esau, right? Here we have the Moabites. And so they're also, this is all enemy land that God has carved out a people that he has given this land to, right? The land of Israel is the most sacred thing that the people of Israel have. David is told to go up to Hebron. Hebron is in Judea, right? Which would be the tribe of Judah. Right there is Hebron, right? Hebron. Up here is Jerusalem, Bethlehem. These are some of the more famous cities in the scriptures. Jericho's over here. Here you have Hebron, all right? Now, Hebron is, this is a very important concept. It's important to remember where David came from. David was not currently living in Israel. Saul had chased him so hard and so fast, actually had dedicated 3,500 special forces troops of his own men to finding one guy, that David had no choice but to flee the land that God had given him, and he actually went to his sworn enemy for help. And his enemy, Achish, is where he found refuge in the city of Ziklag. And then the Philistines went up to war against Israel. We see this a lot, the Philistines warring against Israel. And so David, as a mercenary of Achish, was going to go up with them and fight his own people. He was what he was afraid of. But he got relieved of it because Achish said, no, the other guys think that you'll be treacherous. I believe in you, but they don't, so you should stay back. So they stay back. In the meantime, the Philistines do go up against the kingdom of Israel, and the Philistines wipe out the Israelite army, particularly Saul and Jonathan. Now, Saul is who? King of Israel. That's right. His son Jonathan would be heir to the throne. But we know, and trust me, the people of Israel know as well, that who has been anointed? David's been anointed to be king. So now the real king is dead, but he does have sons. David is the anointed king of Israel, and he's not currently living in Israel, which is why, after the death of Saul and Jonathan, he says to God, "Should I go back home?" And the answer is yes. Where should I go? You should go to Hebron. Now, this is formational and important because Hebron is not just any city. Does anybody know what Hebron is? That's right. Hebron is a city of refuge. It's not just any city of refuge. It's the chief city of refuge. Before we get into cities of refuge, it's important to remember three things. Number one, Hebron is the chief city of refuge. Number two, Israel is a nation of tribes. Number three, this is a warrior culture. Let's read these three things together. Number one, Hebron is the chief city of refuge. Number two, Israel is a nation of tribes. Number three, this is a warrior culture. This is very, very, very important. All right? City of refuge, or cities of refuge, are located throughout the nation of Israel. There are six cities of refuge. There's one down here in Hebron. Right, and if you can see the map close enough, which some of you can't, the cities of refuge have hollow circles. The other cities have solid circles. So there's a city of refuge here at Hebron. There's one up here at Ramoth-Gilead, one at Golan, one at Kadesh, and one at Shechem. Right, these are the cities of refuge, and the cities of refuge are important because the law of God is based around a redemption, restitution concept. In other words, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. If you kill one of my relatives, I have the right to seek justice on your part. And if you have taken a life, then you should give a life. Now, the problem with this is, what if I kill somebody accidentally, right? What if I'm plowing with someone and, you know, I accidentally run their foot over and they bleed to death? Well, it still is eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Their family members still have a right to seek me and to seek retribution, which is why God created the cities of refuge. The cities of refuge are places that you go when you're in trouble. If you go to a city of refuge, they are Levitical cities. If you remember, the tribe of Levi did not receive any land. There is no such thing as a tribe land-wise of Levi. The tribe of Levi are the priests. And so if I get in trouble, I can go to one of the priestly cities, one of the cities of refuge, and I will be safe. This is one of the gates of Hebron. As you can see, a gate is not just a doorway. A gate is a building. A gate is a structure. If you can get in this door, and if you can get past halfway down that tunnel, you're safe. But you got to get halfway. Right? I was at a monastery in Ireland, and there was a gate that was over here, and about 15 feet away there was another gate, and right in the middle was a rock with a cross carving on it. And the monasteries were set up with the city of refuge concept. And if somebody was running from the law, they could come into the gate. And until they crossed that cross, they weren't safe. But once they did, no one could come any further. Same basic concept, right? If you could get into the gate, this is an important point, this halfway through the gate concept. So this is Hebron. Hebron is a city of refuge, and these are the tribes of Israel. Now, you got to think in terms of the culture for this time, right? This is thousands of years before Christ. This is not civilized people like we think of civilization today. They're very civilized for their time and space where they are. But all the world is tribal. All the world is a warrior culture. This is all, I mean, do you really, no, you don't. We don't. None of us do. Realize how close at hand death was for these people. Death was just, it was just part of life. I mean, for a woman to have three children die immediately after childbirth is no strange thing. Death just followed you, right? The median age, if you broke age 45, you were old. You know, when they talked about gray hair setting in, they really meant it. Like, you know, I have a 12-year-old now, and I have more gray hair. You know, I'm getting there. I'm becoming a wise person, but I'm only 35. 10 more years, then Jay gets knocked off. That's just life. This is how we live, you know? Death is always at hand. It is a warrior culture. Tribal alliances and interfighting is the culture of the day. For the Philistines to just sit around a table one day and go, you know what we should do next week? We should go attack the nation of Israel. Why? Because they're there. And 500 years ago, you know, my daddy said to his daddy that his wife was ugly. And so now we should go fight them. Right? I mean, this is, people went to war over insults against wives. People went to war over intrusion on boundaries. People went to war because we heard that the Israelites went and fought the Amalekites and got a lot of spoils and brought it home. So now we know that they're loaded, so the Philistines are going to go and take all the stuff that they just brought back from the Amalekites. Treaties are made and broken like it's people's jobs. I mean, it is a crazy time. Tribal warfare. To say that the nation of Israel made up of 12 tribes, we tend to think of that like, oh, they had 12 peaceful states. It's like New England. No. These people had fierce tribal identity and fierce tribal loyalties that they would gladly fight over at the drop of a hat. You can read Chronicles and see all the inter-tribal fighting that there is. Right? This is what we would consider an uncivilized tribal culture. We should take off the uncivilized part. I tell you what, 1,000 years from now, people are going to think weird things about us too. Right? We are going to be uncivilized to a lot of people at some point. Can you believe they invented atom bombs? What a bunch of morons. And then they wiped themselves off the face of the earth. Oh, who would have thought? What a bunch of idiots. This is us. We're the idiots that people are going to look back on. Tribal warfare and interfighting. It is no surprise that Judah would say, you know what? We're going to do things differently than the rest of you guys. You know why? Because we can. We're huge. We have a lot of land and a lot of people. Furthermore, God has told us that our tribe is going to be the one that the Messiah comes through. So for Judah to say, hey, we're behind David, and for the rest of everybody else to say, hey, we're not so sure about that because we were loyal to Saul, this is perfect cultural sense, right? This is also a warrior culture, right? Things are decided by fighting. This is a male-dominated society that is decided based on pure male guttural instincts, right? You put your head down, and you bull through it, and you fight, and who's ever physically stronger generally wins on a lot of levels. God, should I go up? Yes, you should go up. Where should I go? To Hebron. God sends David to a city of refuge. He knows that he's going to be in trouble. And he also knows that it'll be a safe place for him. So, David went up from there. Verse 2. And his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. Now, if you remember, David had brought to himself a very strong army. I mean, some of the greatest warriors that Israel ever knew were some of David's mighty men. David had at least 600, probably at this point closer to 1,000 men, who were extremely loyal to David and fought with him as his army. And, verse 4, the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. All right, so we've gotten that. Now that David is in the land of Israel again, now that he's in Hebron again, and now that the men of Judah have come to him and have again anointed him, this time as the official political king over Judah, a key question has to be answered. We all know that David had proven his ability to win in battle, but did he have what it takes to rule as king? You know, a king's got to be smart. A king's got to know when to send the army out and when to send the diplomats out. A king's got to know when to be very aggressive and when to hold back. A king's got to understand a lot of things about how to be who it is that he is supposed to be. We know David can win in battle. We know he's a warrior, but can he rule as a king? Can he be wise? Can he be smart? And I think that the point of this text is that David really struggles with this question, which should make us feel really good, right? We know that Jay can preach, but can he patiently love his children? Huh. That's a good question, right? Right? We know that Jim Bob can make 100 grand a year, but does he have what it takes to live by faith in God by giving it all away? We all ask these questions, and we all struggle with these things. When they told David it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul, David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed by the Lord because you have shown this loyalty to King Saul, your Lord, and buried him. Now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now, therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." Three important things to remember is that Hebron is a city of refuge, Israel is a nation of tribes, and this is a warrior culture. And so it is no surprise that the men of Jabesh-Gilead had buried Saul because they were loyal to King Saul. They were part of the north. They were part of the northern tribes who were very loyal to King Saul. So Jabesh-Gilead, they did what they were supposed to do, which was to bury the king and honor him. But look at what David does. David either makes a very smart or a very political move, possibly both. And he sends gifts, and he sends honor to the men of Jabesh-Gilead to say, "Thank you for taking care of the king in this way." David knows that he's meant to rule all of the nations of Israel. He's got to figure out some kind of a way to make that happen, because as of now, only the men of Judah have recognized him as king, and the other 10 tribes were very, very loyal to King Saul. So here David is. Can he rule as king, or will he be stuck? This is a warrior culture, though, and so things will generally be decided by fighting. Now, there is quite a cast of characters in the text that we're about to enter into. Because this is a warrior culture, I've broken this down for all of us so that we can understand it better, right? So here we have a lot of fighting that's going to be happening through chapters 2 and chapters 3. Here, first you have the house of Saul, right? The house of Saul is basically Abner and Ishbosheth, right? Abner, as you can see, strong warrior, commander of Saul's armies. Ishbosheth, we're going to find out, is Saul's 40-year-old son, who's basically a yes man, just a weakling. All he can do is stand there and salute. Abner does all the hard work for the north, right? Ishbosheth basically does whatever Abner tells him to. We're also going to be introduced to the house of David. The house of David, particularly in this text, is going to be composed of three men, or four men. Number one is David, obviously, who's a great leader. And then three brothers, Joab, who you may have heard of before, Abishai, his brother, and Azahel. Azahel is the youngest of the brothers. So this fight is about to go down in a lot of different ways for a lot of different reasons with a lot of different outcomes. Abner, verse 8, Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, remember, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead and the Asherites and Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all Israel. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel. And he reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. Right? He keeps coming back to this. The house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. So it apparently took Ishbosheth a while to build the political clout that he needed to put Ishbosheth into the kingship. But as we're going to see, Ishbosheth is just a puppet. Abner is the key guy in this. Abner, the son of Ner, this is verse 12, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon, and they sat down, the one on the one side of the pool, the other on the other side of the pool. Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and compete before us." So what we have here, two full-blown armies decide to maybe be a little bit smarter to begin with, okay? And so instead of just going on a full-scale battle, they whittle things down to where they just choose a couple of people to fight, 12 to be exact, right? One for each tribe. We'll see how this thing plays itself out. "Let the young men arise and compete before us," Abner says. Joab thinks about it, says, okay. Good question. Where's David? Where's David here? Gibeon is not far north of Hebron. It would have been a safe trip for David. It's a long trip for Abner and for his men. And David has sent Joab, who we're going to see time and time again in 2 Samuel. Joab can be a real scoundrel. He can also be really helpful. But he can be a real scoundrel, too. And if you're trying to build your kingdom on the foundation, shouldn't there be some kind of like kingly presence in this situation? But, you know, what are you going to do? All right, Abner, the son of Ner. Like I said, I think David struggles with this. Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, they went out, 14. "Let the young men arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." Then they arose and passed over by number, 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each caught his head by the each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in the opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called Helkath Hazarim, which is at Gibeon. And the battle was very fierce that day. And Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. So Abner's 12 guys are over here, and David's 12 guys are over here, or Joab's 12 guys are over here, and they fight each other. And they're very evenly matched, so much so that each one kills the other. In the course of this hand-to-hand combat, which is obviously done with spears and swords and shields and that kind of thing, they both end up killing each other, apparently by grabbing each other around the head and shoving their dagger into their side. This is a warrior culture. And before you know it, 24 dead dudes are on the ground. Now, this does not make everybody else that came around happy, right? I mean, these are their friends. These are the guys that they fight with. This is a warrior culture. This is a brotherhood of soldiers who live and work together. This is their livelihood. This is how they work. This group of, you know, civilized sparring match between these two groups as they kill each other erupts into what becomes a full-blown battle. And the men of Joab prevail against the men of Abner. And the three sons of Zeruiah were there. Joab and Abishai and Azahel. Now, Azahel was as swift of foot as a wild gazelle. They say that of me as well. And Azahel pursued Abner. And as he went, he turned neither to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is it you, Azahel?" And he answered, "It is I." Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left and seize one of the young men and take his spoil." But Azahel would not turn aside from following him. Abner said to Azahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" But he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, so that the spear came out of his back. A warrior culture. And he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. So this is what happens. If Abner is the lord of Saul's army, chances are this guy's on a chariot, right? And all of his men are running behind him. And so Asahel, who is as swift as a gazelle, apparently, which means he's wicked fast, is running after this procession, right? These two, there's this battle. Abner's team is losing, and so they run. And Asahel and Abishai and Joab and their men are pursuing Abner and his men as they run away. Abner, probably in a chariot. And Asahel is out in front because he's the fastest guy. And Abner looks behind him, and he knows him, because these guys have been fighting together for years, right? This conflict has only erupted lately. Saul was the king. wars happened. When they fought the Philistines, it was everybody on one side. We go back to our lands and fight each other. But when a common enemy comes, we band together, you know, to beat the common enemy. These guys know each other. They know what's going on. Abner turns around, and there's Azahel. He doesn't want to kill Azahel. But he understands why Azahel wants to get him, because now they're on different sides. And so he yells back, "Is that you? It's me. Don't come after me, because I'll kill you. Get one of the other guys. Feel free to go to the right or the left into that melee and take whatever you want to from them. But if you come after me, I'm going to kill you." Now, here's the thing. You won't read a commentary that tells you this, folks. You only get this at Cornerstone on Sunday morning. I don't think that Abner wanted to kill Azahel. I think he liked him. And I think he liked Joab, too. I think they were probably brothers in combat from fighting Philistines and Amalekites and everybody else. He didn't want to kill him. What part of the spear hit Azahel? The butt. He just wanted to knock him off his feet. This is like a rubber bullet would be today. You put the guy down, but you don't kill him. What he didn't take into account was the amount of forward momentum that Azahel had going. Right? And so I think what Abner does is he turns his spear around. It's not point end first, and I think that he whips it at Azahel. Azahel's got so much momentum coming this way, and that spear has so much momentum coming this way, that when it hits him in the stomach, it just simply punctures, and it goes right through him. And he falls there, and he dies. Abner, for some reason, wants to keep a relationship with Joab, right? He says, "How will I lift up my face again to your brother if I kill you?" Verse 24, now the situation has changed, because now these guys, the three of these who are brothers, have now lost their baby brother. And these two have a situation at hand. And if you remember, this is a warrior culture. And they just lost one of their brothers, which means they have a right to retribution. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. So these three are chasing after Abner. Asahel falls, and Joab and Abishai continue following Abner. Verse 24, Joab and Abishai pursue Abner, and as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gaia on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner and became one group and took their stand on the top of a hill, right? A key point of terrain. A great place to defend is on the top of a hill. A terrible place to attack is going up a hill. If you've never gone on a trek to Gettysburg and seen Little Round Top, you should do that. And you can see why the 20th Maine, this little group of guys, could defend this place so tenaciously. Right? I mean, Abner's a smart dude. Up on top of a hill, all of his men decide to make a stand. The people of Benjamin gathered themselves together. Verse 26, then Abner called to Joab, "Will the sword devour forever? Do you not know the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of your brothers?" Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would have not given up the pursuit of their brothers till the morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight anymore. So this fight comes to a standstill, a declared truce between the two leaders of the armies. Nobody wins. Joab goes back home. Abner goes back home. David is still king of Judah. Ish-bosheth is still king of the north and the northern tribes. Not a lot has changed, except there's a lot more dead people. Abner and his men went all that night through the Arabah. That's the land between the Galilee and the sea and the Dead Sea. They crossed the Jordan, and marching the whole morning, they came to Mahanaim. Joab returned from the pursuit of Abner. When he had gathered all the people together, there were missing from David's servants 19 men besides Azahel. So they lost 20 guys in the course of this battle this day. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin 360 of Abner's men. See what I mean? Like, David had the army. He was a force to be reckoned with. They took up Azahel and buried him in the tomb of his father, which was at Bethlehem. And Joab and his men marched all night, and the day broke upon them at Hebron. And then things do settle into something much more of a larger scale. Verse 1, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. Civil war erupts in Israel. We tend to think of the divided nation of Israel as being something that Jeroboam and Rehoboam caused to happen. You've got to understand that all through David's reign, he never has a truly solid grip on the northern tribes. I mean, they become very, very loving toward David and very thankful for all the power and prestige that he brings to Israel. But when push really starts to come to shove, there's never a true solid grip that David has. But chapter 3, verse 1 tells us what happens in this situation. The house of David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel. His second was Kileab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. And the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. And the fourth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream of Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. Why does the writer tell us this? Because David's got six wives. Anybody else think that's nuts? I don't mean that to slap on wives. I mean, like, this dude is so clearly against God's law at this point, it's ridiculous. What's David thinking? See what I mean? We know David can win in battle. We know David, at his sweet spot, is unbeatable. But will David round out his character in a way that he can rule as a king? And David's struggling. He's struggling. It's hard for him. And like I said, let's not be judgmental. I think we all know what that's like. There's a sweet spot that every one of us that, yep, I can do that. I can do that. I can do that well. And we tend to put all of our identity and focus and significance there. But there are these other pieces of us out here and over here that engage people. And they affect us in our real lives. They affect our friends and our family. And they affect us when we fall to them. Yeah, we can operate in our sweet spot, but when God calls us to be a truly whole person who's truly wholly engaged with him the way he calls us to be, do we have what it takes? Will we allow him to do that kind of surgical work on us? This wives issue is a big thing for David. It comes back to find him several times. You'll see what I mean. While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, as you can see, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. All right, now, this is important. Again, remember, this dude Abner, this guy is smart. He is a politician's politician. He is not just a great commander of an army, because he was. He is smart. Like, he's got it. He's into it. And he understands who Ishbosheth is. He understands that this guy doesn't have a lot of backbone. And so he, in the meantime, like the text says, is making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now, Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. If you don't know what a concubine is a woman that you use for sex. Kings and powerful people have this in this culture and in this day. You have your wives, but then you would generally pick some of the more beautiful women in the region, and those become your concubines. You know, it's a lot of things going wrong here. Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my..." I'm sorry, did I skip something? I think I did. Saul had a concubine, and Ishbosheth said to Abner, oh no, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" All right, Saul had this concubine. When Ishbosheth becomes king, whose concubine does he become? Does she become? Ishbosheth's, right? All that was Saul's becomes Ishbosheth's as king, which means that Abner actually goes into Ishbosheth's concubine. Ishbosheth uses his father's name just to show that he's got authority. Abner freaks out. Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba." And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he was afraid of him. Like I said, this guy Abner is smart. How does the text start in chapter 3? The house of David warred with the house of Saul, and the house of David got stronger and stronger. The house of Saul got weaker and weaker. Do we think that Abner didn't pick up on this? There's a reason why Abner put Ishbosheth into place to begin with. That's because Ishbosheth is the legal head of the northern tribes. So if someone is going to take the fall for a defeat, it's not going to be Abner. It's going to be the king of the north, which is Ishbosheth. Abner knows this. Abner sees things going bad. He sees the house of David getting stronger and stronger. He sees the house of Saul getting weaker and weaker. And so Abner looks for a political play to make. So he goes and he sleeps with one of Ishbosheth's women. Ishbosheth comes to him to confront him about it, and he uses that as a reason to get angry with Ishbosheth and say, "Fine, forget you anyway. I'm going to go help David now. Too bad for you. Dude is smart. He's also treacherous and evil. Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf saying, I think I might have skipped some movements here. I said that. Yeah, okay, so these two had a conversation. These two had a conversation, which caused these two to have a conversation. Verse 12, Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf saying, to whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you. Abner says to David, make your covenant with me. So the question is, what is Abner talking about? What covenant is being made here? Abner wants to lead David's armies. Abner wants to be the commander of David's armies. Make a covenant with me. Let's make an agreement between you and me. You give me a cabinet position, and I'll make sure you get the presidency. Right? This is how it would work in our culture. And he said, good. I will make a covenant with you, David says. Good. I will make a covenant with you. One thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, go, return. And he returned. If you remember, David fell hard for Michal, Saul's daughter, before he and Saul had their big falling out. And he said, I want to marry her. And in those days, you always pay a dowry. You know? And so Saul said, well, here's the dowry. I want 100 foreskins from the Philippines. I want you to go into a city. What did I say now? Did I say Philippines? Yeah. Are you serious? Yeah. Man, I'm excited about the trip. What do you want? I'm excited to teach these people. Okay. We don't want Filipino foreskins. We want Filistino foreskins. Okay. Higher quality or something. Okay. So, right. When I was growing up in our church one day, Vincent, you know, we had the song leader who would get up and he would wave his arms. You know, my dad did this sometimes. Actually, he did it regularly. The guy that filled in for him one time got up and decided to read a psalm. And in the psalm, I forget what psalm it was, it used the word incense three times in about six verses. But this guy kept saying incest. He would read it, may our incest go up before you. And then he would stop himself and be like, I'm sorry, incense. And then two verses later, as you smell our incest, you know, man. And it's just, and he's turning like six shades of red. I'm so sorry. But he can't not do it. It's just stuck, like me in the Philippines, apparently. So, anyway, all right. Good times. What was I talking about? Circumcision, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Saul understands that David is a worthy opponent to the throne. Yeah, you can marry my daughter. If you go get 100 Philistine, go circumcise 100 Philistines, then you can have my daughter. And David does it. He pulls it off. He doesn't get killed. It's an astronomical concept. But in the meantime, then David has to run. Saul, in an act of treachery toward David, takes Michal, David's wife, and marries her off to another man named Paltiel. Now, apparently Paltiel really fell for this girl. Like, he loved his wife. When David reclaimed her, he followed them weeping the whole way until they got about halfway there, in which case Abner was just like, go home. You're not going to get your way. Which is, I think, a very interesting point in the text, because a few chapters later, we're going to see Michal turn on David. And I think that there's something to do here with Paltiel. I think they really loved each other. Interesting stuff. In all of this, is David righteous? Is David righteous in allowing Joab to speak for him? Is David righteous in making this political deal in the back room with Abner, knowing that Joab is already the commander of his army? Who is David trusting here? Who's David looking to make him king? Is he being smart? Is he using wisdom? Is he not using wisdom? Is he getting outside of God's will, where God wants to establish his kingdom and his throne? Is David playing in the background trying to establish his own throne? Like I say, there's not a lot of key principles to pull out here. The text doesn't tell us. Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, all right, so he's back home with the men of Saul. For some time past, you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. Abner also spoke to Benjamin. Then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that you may make a covenant with you, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. So Abner comes, and there's this big feast, and David is welcoming him and welcoming what he brings. This alliance has been cast now. Abner can deliver the 10 tribes of Israel that David doesn't have into his allegiance, and they will anoint him king of Israel. Abner has done what he said that he would do. But don't forget that he asked David to make a covenant with him. Also, don't forget what had happened earlier, because there's another player that comes into the story now. Just then, the servants of David, verse 22, arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he let him go, and he has gone in peace. Then Joab went to the king and said, what have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you've sent him away so that he is gone? You know that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, and to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you are doing. Right, so he's saying, Joab's now saying to David, Abner's trying to work this political thing in the background. In the meantime, though, we know that Joab is the commander of David's army. We know that Abner is the commander of Saul's army in the north, and that Abner has just delivered those 10 tribes to David. Joab is fully aware of what hangs in the balance here. Not only that, let's not forget that Joab is still ticked off at the fact that his brother Asahel is dead. Who killed Asahel? Abner. When Joab, verse 26, came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah. But David did not know anything about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside, where? Into the midst of the gate. Remember how the gate worked? He could not have killed Abner in the city. He could not have killed Abner on the half of that gate that was closest to the city. He took him to the middle. He took him past the middle point into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him. Where? In the stomach. Where did Asahel get struck? In the stomach. Right? Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. There he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. And, in my opinion, to protect himself. Afterward, when David heard of it, so he strikes him down. And he kills him. He kills Abner, who is the political force in the north. And, I mean, people are aware of that. They know Ish-bosheth's not a strong leader. They know that Abner is. Right? And so, in the midst of this now, Abner has come to Hebron and has now been murdered there. Abner had just done what? Delivered the allegiance of the 10 tribes in the north. So now who's stuck? David's stuck. Because the commander of the north has now been murdered treacherously in his city. How will the north now respond to this act of treachery? Will they withdraw their allegiance? What will they do? Key question. Does David have what it takes to rule as a king? Verse 28. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house, and may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai his brother killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. So David does not want to lose the allegiance of the north. Right? David has understood the cost that this came at. He doesn't have what it takes to make it happen without Abner. He doesn't want to lose this, so he chooses to curse Joab, because Joab's the one that murdered him. And he one without a discharge, leprous, spindle, death by the sword, or who lacks bread. There are three things in ancient history that if this trifecta ever finds you, you're done. War, famine, disease. If those three things are ever happening at the same time in your country in ancient history, you're finished. Your civilization is over. Someone will come in and take you over. What does he wish on Joab? War, famine, and disease. Then Joab said to David and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner." And King David followed the bier. They buried Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner. And all the people wept, and the king lamented for Abner, saying, "Should Abner die as a fool dies, your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, so you have fallen." And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. But David swore, saying, "God do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down." And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner, the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." David, like we said, is in this place of what's right, what's wrong. This is an intricate story with a lot of moving pieces and multiple storylines. And this decision affects these people positively, these people negatively. But if the other decision affects these people positively and these people negatively. And in the midst are these power-playing people behind the scenes. And here is David in the midst of it all. Not yet a seasoned king. Not even a king at all. Just trying to figure things out. He's not even reigning in Jerusalem yet. He's still in Hebron. What is David to do? Who is he becoming? And I think that in this text we see David do some things very well. And we see David make some serious mistakes, which is the story of this man, which is the beauty of 2 Samuel. This is a painting by a German artist, Peter Fromm, and it's called King David. I love it because it's so disfigured. We tend to see David, like if you go on the online and Google King David paintings, what you'll see is like a lot of regal stuff. In fact, there's one of my favorites is David, and he's a white guy, and he's got this crown on his head that like Henry VIII would have worn, one of these medieval coats on him with those little black pointy things sticking out of the white. And he's sort of like gazing up into heaven with a harp. David would have looked at that and said, "Who in the world is that?" But if you said, "David, I made a painting of you. Wonderful, let me see it." And then showed him this, I think David would be like, "Yep, that's exactly how I felt." Yeah, confused, wondering. Sort of disjointed and broken. Hands on the harp, certainly, but eyes turned away. You know, still growing, still morphing, still becoming, shapeless, formless, a bit chaotic, but yet still really rich, deep textures and colors. Like, I think David would say, "Yes, this is, like, I can feel this thing." I mean, have you ever had an experience in your life where after you were done the experience, you look back at yourself and you were like, "You know, I don't know that I did what was right in that situation, but I don't know what else I could have done." I've had that situation. Like, I just felt like I lacked, you know, like it wasn't, like what I really needed was for God to leave a voicemail on my phone to tell me exactly what to do. But he's never done that for me. He requires me to seek him and to push into him and to find him. And the amount of grace that he gives in the midst of those bad decisions is just huge. And the amount of grace he gives in the midst of good decisions that sometimes I make purely on accident, also huge. Psalm 118 is one of these psalms that David would have penned while at Hebron. Listen to what David says. Team, you can come back up. "Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His steadfast love endures forever. Let Israel say, his steadfast love endures forever. Let the house of Aaron say, his steadfast love endures forever. Let those who fear the Lord say, his steadfast love endures forever. Out of my distress, I called on the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me free. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do to me? The Lord is on my side as my helper. I shall look in triumph on those who hate me. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in men. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes. Right? I mean, can you hear 2 Samuel 2 and 3? And in that, like the trust in humans, the trust in princes, the trust in the fear of men, as opposed to the fear of the Lord. Like all of this is swirling and moving in and around David. And it's meant to take you, the reader, the believer, the follower of Jesus, into this swirl. The last thing that you need is to be spoon-fed a biblical principle, neat and tidy, for you to take home this week. Please enter the chaos, the swirling of this. Think about yourself. Maybe you're treacherous like Joab. Maybe you use wisdom wrongly like Abner. Maybe you're super fast but not so smart like Azahel. Maybe you too need to enter into one of these stories and say, man, God, I see Joab in myself. I see David in myself. I see Abner in me. I see Ishbosheth in me. Right? This is how God intends us to interact with these deep narratives of Scripture. Going into it and being in it, then listening for what it is that God would say to us through it. Instead of taking the text, possibly analyzing it or exegeting it rightly, and trying to draw simple truths out of it. We understand the simple truths here. The simple truths here is God is doing his thing with his king. We get that. But he's doing his thing with his son and through his favor, through this chaotic experience, through this confusion, through all these moving pieces and things that God has something for you in, but you have to get in it. Like you've got to get into it. A lot of you have been told in your whole life that you don't understand the Bible. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. By virtue of who you are, you do. You might need to listen to it instead of read it. You might need to take it in smaller chunks than two chapters at a time. You might need to read the same thing every day for a month. But yes, you do have what you need to engage the Scriptures with God. Enter into this. This is a fantastic story. If nothing else, I told you guys a great story today that God wrote and that you and I are a part of. Like, take the richness that is here and see what it is that God has for you in it. But you have to get in it. You've got to put yourself in it. Not try and stand subjectively outside of it and be like, oh, there's a good principle for me. Although I hope you find good principles for you. Don't get me wrong. It's just that when that's all that we start looking for, we miss the richness of the humans who are actually experiencing this stuff. And then we miss the richness of our own human experience. And that's a shame. We become Christians who just sort of pick up our Bibles here and there, and we do things because it's our devotional time, and then we move from it. But it doesn't really get us. This is meant to get you, to make you think and to make you work, to make you question. And in that, you will find God revealing things to you, because God does what with chaos? He creates out of it. The earth was without form and void. Chaos ruled over the face of the deep. And God said, let there be light. God takes chaos and he makes beautiful things out of it. So please get into the chaos of the Bible and allow God to create something beautiful in your life. Let's pray. God, we praise you and thank you for the beauty of your Scriptures to us. We worship you, God. You are great. You are King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And we lift you up. Thank you for your word. Thank you for men and the stories that you give us, like David and Abner and Saul and Jonathan, the good and the bad. The good decisions, the bad decisions, the wisdom, the folly, just the depth and the richness of this experience, for us to enter that with you, to see you. What a beautiful gift. In this text, God, David is in a process of becoming king. We recognize today that you're king, that you are the King of Kings, and we worship you. God, make us unafraid to enter into your chaos. And not just the chaos of Scripture, God. But bottom line is, our lives get chaotic. There are all kinds of noise and chaos that comes into our world and into our situations, and that affects our marriages and our children and our educations and our friendships, our workplaces, our home environments. Chaos is something that we as Christians and as humans try to run away from. No matter how much we run, I mean, it still finds us. God, teach us to embrace chaos. Teach us to name you as Lord, as King over that chaos, that we might see you making beautiful things out of it in our lives. Yeah, we bless you, God. Thank you for your servant, David. In Jesus' name, amen.